Well, thank you. That was very moving and appreciated. And we also thank Sister Alice for the kind invitation.
No, I'm not.
Oh, you're not. I did not.
Okay.
We thank Alice for the kind invitation. Oh, that's an interesting beginning to our talk today.
Oh, she let go of that role quite quickly.
So, friends, Mary and I, as you've heard from the introduction, we've been addressing this issue for a long time, and it's especially nice to be with a group of folks who have their own spiritual devotion and sensitivity. That isn't always the case with audiences we speak to. So, for us, the nice part of that is we can relax and just directly address the sacred and spiritual nature of our work, which actually is at the base or foundation of our work. So a beginning idea I'd like to present to you is this notion that the times of dying and grieving are spiritually auspicious times. The suffering and the pain that often accompanies these processes, that's obvious. We don't have to convince anyone of that. But there is always, our favorite way of saying it is, there's always grace with suffering. Always. I tend not to use the words always and never, except in special cases, and this is one of them. There is always grace in suffering. So we see ourselves as almost like midwives to this process. Folks who find themselves with a terminal diagnosis, or folks who are grieving the loss of a loved one. Is it that true that these times were broken open in a certain way? You wouldn't wish this on anyone, but it's part of life. And so it's something we all go through, and in those times, we help folks look at the opportunities available to them. While acknowledging and caring for the pain and the suffering, mixed in, however skillfully we can do that, depending on each person, to help them see this opportunity to deepen their self-understanding and to really examine, in perhaps a deeper way, these questions that come up when we're faced with the fact that we're mortal and our time here is limited. What is the nature of life? What is the meaning of life? What is the meaning of my life? Where am I going? Who am I really? All of these deeper questions that are so mixed together between our day-to-day existential existence and our, whatever words you choose to use, relationship to God, your religious faith. Some folks like the word divine, the sacred dimension within us. Folks who aren't even particularly identified with religious organizations often use words, is it not true, like intuitive or transcendent. There are these dimensions to our experience that do not come through our five senses or through our rational faculties of mind. They appear through them, but their source is somehow beyond, beyond this. So that's one idea. There is always grace in suffering. Another idea, which is in a way like stating the obvious, and by the way, may I add, this conversation on these topics is immense. We could sit here, I'm not exaggerating, taking breaks, we can sit here for days and days and days and days and days talking about all the dimensions and pieces of this. And if we start sharing our personal stories, which is wonderful, I feel that's how we really learn from each other, then the days and days become weeks and weeks. And pretty soon we have a community that we have, huh? With a purpose. So Toss, this is the grand conversation, capital G, capital C, that human beings can have. This is a profound issue. What does it mean to be alive? What does it mean to be a creature, a being who has an awareness of his or her own mortality, which separates us from our animal friends? We're aware of this. What is the meaning and implication of that? The questions it raises, the fear that often accompanies that realization. And to go into that fear and face that fear. Now, I usually start our talk, and I'll do my best to lay a foundation, and then I'm going to pass the microphone and the baton over to Mary, who will more specifically look into these, what we've discovered about these processes. So, in terms of a second major point, may I state the obvious, that living, dying, and grieving are inseparable. When we experience fear and concern, we often see them as hard times or somehow separate from our daily life. But that's not really the truth. The nature of life has changed, is it not? Everything is changing. Not just our physical body, every single day, but our careers change, relationships change, through death or divorce, whatever. Everywhere, the leaves on a tree, We adopt our pets when they're kittens or puppies, and we see them through their lives, and we watch them go, Usually we outlive our pets. So change is everywhere. Thoughts change, feelings change. We joke about mood swings and different feelings at different times, and there's another day or two conversation. I wasn't joking. All of these dimensions come into play. So you might say living and dying. Okay, life and death are defined in terms of one another. You cannot literally think of one. One has no meaning without thought of the other, implicitly or explicitly. If in fact loss that accompanies change in life is also the truth, then grieving is part of that fabric. So a third point I'd like to suggest here at the beginning, this will be kind of the orange juice concentrate version of our longer talk at this point, is that whenever you have been emotionally attached to someone or something, when that thing changes, there's your degree of grief. To the extent, another way to say it, to the extent that you need things to remain the same. There's no judgment meant here. Just seeking observationally. To the extent that our happiness is based on things remaining the same, there's your degree of grief when that thing changes. Please don't shoot the messengers. Because they will change. You can bet on it. It's part of nature. Another thing to remember, death and dying are part of nature. And we all say we love nature. We have this beautiful view of the ocean, and especially the Santa Barbara area, all year round, the flowers and the beauty of the place. And again, we love our animal. You can tell I'm really attached to the wagon like that. And we say we love nature until someone reminds us that dying is part of nature. And then all of a sudden nature is not too popular. It's somehow we push this out of our minds. And our fear often and concerns take over. Our grief may even overwhelm us at times. But I'd like to be a voice to remind you that death is part of nature's way. And if I may quote our friend Stephen Levine, to develop a confidence in the process of dying. To trust nature. And certainly here within the context of your spiritual faith, to hold and remember that transcendent reality. Now, in the Christian context, we very often refer to that as the soul. My guess is everyone in this room, to one extent or another, has a true belief that there's a part of them that is independent and will continue on, independent of their body and mind, and will continue on. Huh? When we have a friend who says, when the lease is up, then we're evicted from our apartment. Huh? We're only here for a short time, and it's nature's lease. So, looking at the clock here, I think it'd be best to just focus on now, if I may, with having said what is so obvious about change, if you turn that over, there's another side. And I invite you just to reflect on what part of you never changes. We say the soul is eternal. What do we mean by that as an experience? I'm sure we could have interesting theological and philosophical discussions, you probably all have had those, about the nature of soul and spirit and what this means. But are you with me? To live it is a whole nother, how do we drop from here to here? Where the truth of that becomes so much a part of us, our fear of death dissolves. Not out of denial or not out of talking someone out of it, which is impossible anyway. Mm-hmm. But because truly we cease to be afraid of this thing called dying. And what is that process? So in that context, and you will find this expanded upon it in our book, if you'd like to go more deeply into this, but here in the spirit of introduction, I'd like to offer you 6 experiences or ways of touching that which doesn't change in a way that's more familiar to us. It's inspiring to read about the great saints and mystics and their experiences, and I personally believe that they're true. But on the other hand, they're not experiences that I or most of my friends and colleagues have on a day-to-day basis, which is why saints and great mystics are rare people. I mean, we can probably sit here and generate a list of the great Christian mystics and the experiences they've had. In fact, I'm going to quote in a minute from one of them, which is in the book you're reading, The Imaging Life After Death, in chapter 10, Thomas Merton. But if I may get back to that in a moment. So let me share these 6 characteristics with you. The first one may surprise you. Confidence. Now remember how I am suggesting this. These are doorways into ways you can begin to experience that which never changes in you. When you were 4 years old looking in the mirror, and when you look in the mirror today, and God willing, when you're 95 and you look in the mirror, there's something that hasn't changed, isn't it true? You still say things like, it's me, even though the body's very different. And your thoughts may be different and your feelings. So for today's conversation, let's just say whatever that me is, whatever the feeling is behind that word, that's a common unchanging thread in your life. Confidence. Trust in your experience. We had the good fortune of meeting Mother Teresa in the early 90s, not personally, but being present when she came to a church in San Francisco. She had come from India. And when she walked in the church, you may or may not be aware, Mother Teresa was very short. I don't mean a little short, she was really short. And she came in this procession with these mostly men with their regalia about her. And you could barely physically see her. She was kind of in the middle with the incense and the bells. It was all very beautiful. When she walked by our row in the church, I'm not exaggerating. We all talked about it later. It was like a force hit us. Mm-hmm. Like someone had put their hands on my chest and pushed me. I'm being honest. That's what it felt like. And it was coming from her. And she wasn't doing anything. She was just being Mother Teresa. She was just walking. But her presence, that's an important word to us, presence. It's not charisma, which is of the personality. It's from something deeper. The person may have a joyful or a loving or peaceful presence. Huh? I remember looking over at her and feeling I was looking at someone who knew who she was, what her purpose on earth was, why she was there that day, and she had no concern in the least for what anyone else thought of her. Not in a cold way, but she was so confident in her role in God's universe that others' opinions didn't matter. And if we're honest with ourselves, how often do others' opinions matter? It's a measuring stick, again, not to judge ourselves, but just to learn, not in the presence of these beings that we consider special. So number one is confidence. Number two is fearlessness, to be without fear. Now most of us are afraid in some way of something most of the time. So again, to live in that state is rare, but it's also something we've touched upon. I'm sure you have had times where you have spoken or acted in a way where you weren't concerned about yourself. We have stories like this. Most everyone has an aunt or an uncle somewhere who people in the family call them when there's trouble because they know they will be centered and not get into the emergency of the situation. You seek them for wisdom. You follow? Huh? What I'm saying? That person, that's how I mean fearless. Not the samurai warrior fearless. That's something else. But that person who just fear isn't part of their mind. It doesn't come up in their mind. Number three, peacefulness. I've never met a person who hasn't said that he or she doesn't wish to have peace of mind. This is something we all sense, huh? My wife Valerie is an Episcopal priest, and she speaks in the Episcopal liturgy, they speak of the peace that passeth all understanding. I believe it's in Catholic tradition, and it's probably based in the Bible. Huh? Those words are the English translation of those words from the Aramaic. I invite us to smile together at all the ways you and I disturb our peace of mind during the day. Again, it's a marker, just to observe. Keep those judging voices quiet. We're not here to rest judgment of good or bad. Just to describe. Because the minute we get into good and bad, we get off track, don't we? We kind of forget what we're really about, which is to, if our desire is to directly experience the sacred within. So another marker there to think about. Number four is joyfulness. Joyfulness. Let's see, a year and a half ago, a number of us went to hear the Dalai Lama. You're all familiar with the Dalai Lama. He's in the news again. Tireless. He was giving a talk in Berkeley at the university. Must have been 300-400 people there. And we were about halfway back. So we were quite a distance from him. It was similar to the experience with Mother Teresa, except this time it was joy. He walked out on the stage and I could feel it. I just felt happy. It wasn't like I was thinking of anything. It just happened in his presence. This joy. And he gave this wonderful, inspiring talk. And at the end, a young reporter came up to him and said, "Sir, I have a question." He was very respectful. He said, "Your country has been invaded. The invaders have destroyed most of your temples. They have slaughtered the monks that you raised from boyhood to be priests in your temples. How can you be so joyful?" And the Dalai Lama looked at him. You know what he said? "Shall I give them my mind too?" And he laughed. And then went on to talk about the joy as an inherent quality of what you and I would call soul or spirit. He had other words for it from his tradition. Speak of the eternal self and different ways of speaking about it. But the experience sounded the same. He was talking about that which doesn't change in us. And I laugh to this day every time I think of the story. Every time I get annoyed by someone who cuts me off on the freeway, or, you know, he's remaining joyful watching people be murdered, facing this incredible cruelty. It's helpful to remember, huh? Again, without judgment, just to remember we have options in these moments of how we respond. If experiencing the sacred is really what we say, huh, we wish to gain. Number five, compassion. Love is compassion. Now love, there's another 3 or 4 weeks we could talk. All the different meanings of that word. But here we're speaking of selfless love. Again, not as some distant, hard-to-imagine, rare mystical experience, but the kind of love you have at times in your life when you love someone so much, there's no thought of yourself. Your words, your actions flow from you. Some say, I feel like an instrument of God. They just come through you. You don't give someone a gift because you owe them a present, or you're hoping they'll like you. Or there's no psychology in it. It's out of love. You just do it. There's no thought of yourself, no concern for yourself. There are these stories of these young women who had children where cars have, that you've heard these stories, backed up over the child, and the woman comes up and literally lifts the car off the child. And then, you know, physicists look at this and say, that's impossible. Mm-hmm. Her bone structure and her strength, that's not possible. Yet, we have these stories that are firmly grounded in experience, and we know they're true. So, Mary and I don't claim to have answers, but we love asking the question. You know, what is that? Something beyond time, space, and physical causality is operative in those moments. And then lastly, I'll end on this note and then share this piece from Thomas Merton, which I think some of you, I'm sure a few all of the books have read. Number six is inspiration or enthusiasm. I love to remind people of the Latin roots of those two words, to inspire, in spiritus, to live in spirit, in the presence, presence of spirit. Enthusiasm, entheosism, to live in the presence of God, is to be enthusiastic, truly enthusiastic. And there have been many individuals, the Sufi poet Rumi comes to mind, he's very articulate about this point, that there is a truth beyond pain and pleasure. We're not talking about only pleasant situations. Is there not enthusiasm sometimes when you are challenged by a painful situation, but you keep going to it, you keep facing it? There's some part of you that wishes to master this and get beyond your fear. You're inspired to do this. Anyone hear what I'm saying? It kind of does into the basic Skinnerian model that we do things for pleasure and we avoid things for pain. I think that's true to the extent that we're not aware that we live robotically out of habit, as animals are said to instinctually. But there's this other part in us that is seeking something greater, that wishes to go beyond our habitual, more robotic selves, that avoid pain, which I remind you includes grief and being with Zion, or seeks pleasure, where we forget. We just run after things that are pleasing. So let me end my part with this quote, because this was the piece I was sharing with Alice earlier that tied in most directly for me from chapter 10, and then Mary will make reference to chapter 9. It's on page 84, and I just loved reading this. The contemplative writer Thomas Merton speaks of his own initiation, interesting word, into this kind of seeing and loving. He was at the intersection of a shopping district, suddenly he was overwhelmed with the realization that he loved all these people bustling about him. For a moment, his false sense of separateness lifted. So we're basically talking about number five here. Huh? His own sense of ego self was gone. He saw that in the heart of God, he was one with all humanity. Writing about the experience, Merton explains that there is a place at the center of our being that is untouched by the illusion, it's a powerful word, illusion of separateness. It is a point of nothingness, speaking substantially, where God dwells. Merton compares it to a pure diamond that blazes with heaven's invisible light. He believes that it is in everyone. That's us too. He said the flame would burn away the darkness and cruelty, I think of the Dalai Lama, and cruelty in the world. He says, I have no program for this being. It is only given. It's part of our nature. Is that word nature? Huh? You may say spiritual or sacred nature. The gate of heaven is everywhere. So on that note.
That's very beautiful. And you know, Ron talks about that which doesn't change, and it's so wonderful when we are in that space, you know, and when we're feeling confident, we're feeling fearless, we feel peaceful, we're just really in that space of love and oneness with all. And I've had those moments many, many times, and it's just really, just great. The problem is that most of us also get into the place of feeling when change happens that we don't want it, and we resist it. And those are the places that are hard, and those are the times that we forget. And that's today what I would like to speak to. And on your seats you'll find a paper. Three copies. Thank you for copying these. This is from our book. Our book, by the way, is called Opening to Dying Reading Sacred Journey. And it gives a lot of information in here about the changes, like what y'all was speaking of, as well as the day-to-day working with the grief that comes up from change, and how to not only work with it, but go beyond it and get to the place where we can feel these changeless moments.
We're having a little bit of a technical problem. That is fading in and out. So I'm going to ask you to use this. There you go.
I'll get out of
here. Okay.
I'm out of the floor.
Okay. That's all there is to it. You can either leave this here if you're going to be close to the desk, or stick it in a pocket. You're wired up.
And in the back of our book, we really have a lot of different ways to work with this. Through journaling, through collage work, through meditation, through prayer, through just a lot of different exercises in the book on attachment. So I personally read it every once in a while, and I think, wow, this is really feels like it was guided by a source higher than us in writing this book. But in the grief wheel, as you'll see, it talks about a pattern that we go through when somebody dies or we have some kind of loss, some kind of change. And it's a general pattern that we all, you know, it's like when we're children, we grow up and there's a pattern growing up, and yet everyone is unique in what we go through. With William Warden's grief wheel, you can see that it's the loss, then the shock, then the protest, then the disorganization, the reorganization, and then we finally go into recovery. How many of you know who Elizabeth Kubler-Ross is? Okay, most of you, good. And how she talks about it. Now, she talks about it in the sense of anticipatory loss, where people are dying with the denial and that shock and denial at first, then the anger, and then the bargaining and the depression, and then finally the acceptance. So it's all a general pattern that we go through. In our book, we talk about the first part of it is the resistance and the protest. We don't want this to happen, and it's not necessarily conscious. It comes out from our unconscious. We rebel, and it's that shock and denial. It's that fear that we're afraid. We don't want this to happen. You know, our world is shaken up. And we want that security that nothing's going to change. We want that security because this world can, especially as we go outside instead of inside, the world can be a very scary place to be in. If we have stability, if we have something to anchor ourselves, then we feel like we're safe. But I tell you, one of the things and you all know this, prayer and meditation. When you have that prayer, it can be a mantra for you to do that anchor in life, to stabilize yourself so that you don't have as much fear. The resistance comes in the anger. You know, as long as we're blaming somebody, we don't have to face that pain, that terrible pain that comes from these great losses. The guilt, the angst, and the bargaining, that's another form of wanting to control. We don't want this change to happen, and we feel like, well, somehow we can control it if we feel guilty. I mean, somehow I should have been able to prevent this from happening, you know. Then finally, the realization and the integration, we start to let it seep in. We start feeling like, what is this about, you know? I'm like, well, you know, we feel lonely and we feel like, you know, this. We're starting to feel the sadness and allow it to come in, and rather than continuously pushing it away, we feel kind of depressed. It's interesting in depression. Depression, we have a tendency to shut out. You know, if you feel depressed, then you have to go to the doctor and you got to get medicine, right? Now, grant you a natural depression is different than a clinical depression. There are some famouses. They're both, you have difficulty with eating and with sleeping, and there's a general sense of feeling the sadness. The difference, though, is usually with depression, the natural depression that you feel is more of whatever the change is about. If you have, say your loved one dies, it's generally about that rather than a general self, with a clinical depression, it's a general sense of failure. But I like what Steve Levine has to say, and I'll try and find it. He talks about depression as being something that's beneficial, because now with depression, see that how it goes. In his book, Who Dies, and Steve Levine had a gift for taking grief and change and shifting it into going through it and finding the spiritual benefit of it, the transformation of it, the ability to find our soul, to find the meaning of life. I remember when a conference I went to many, many years ago, one of the things that he was saying was that grief, he was saying that all emotional pain is grief. And I thought, wow, I never thought of that before. But if you know, go through your day-to-day life and look at your feelings. Look at your anger, look at your fear, look at whatever it is where you're in emotional pain. And you'll find, as I have, I mean, I believe that you'll find, as I have, that in fact it is grief. Because grief is the result of loss. Grief is the result of what has changed and we don't want it to change. Okay? Whether it's anticipating the loss or whether it's the actual loss. And so...
just wanted to say how true that rings to a group like this, because a lot of us in this room are grieving our Catholic Church. We feel that we're losing it in some way, or it's losing us. Mm-hmm. There's a separation, there's a distancing, and there's like pain, you know, for a lot of us. Mm-hmm. And it's not personal, it's not like a friend, but it's something else.
The beauty is that. The Catholic Church, I'm Catholic, I'm practicing Catholic. And I love my religion, and I also know that there's a lot of things in my religion that's off the wall. And it's the Catholic Church, even though we like to think of it as a as God coming through it, and I believe that if God is coming through it, because it wouldn't have lasted over 2,000 years if that isn't true. We're still all human, and we're still we're still in the Catholic Church. It's just a bunch of humans that hopefully a lot of God is coming through. I think that the beauty of what is said in our book, if you work with that grief, you are willing to work with that grief and sit with it and not let it possess you. You can sit with it and sort it out. What is true for you and what isn't true for you? Taking what is good and leaving the rest. If you sit with it without getting hooked, you can take and transform your experience of the Catholic Church. You can take what is bad and advocate. You can take what is wrong and let it go. Take the beauty of it and let it shine through you. You know, I like what the Catholic priest Ryan says. He says, he talks all the time about love, and he talks about assuming a light and letting that love shine through and letting people know that this happens too. It's not just these people that are abusing the Catholic Church. It's not just these priests that are having sex with children. It's us. And let that light shine through. what Ron has to say this morning, cultivate the peacefulness, cultivate the love, cultivate the fearlessness, cultivate the confidence, and come from that place like Mother Teresa did. You know, let's all be Mother Teresa. You know, let's all be positive. Let's all be the same. I mean, we have a ways to go to be in that place, but we're our own, that's our own experience. We're all an expression of spirit.
Something. I really appreciate your raising so honestly that issue, because I think it's a human issue. It's certainly an issue in the Catholic Church in our current times. But I think you raise an even deeper question, and what came to my mind is our minds have a tendency, by their nature it seems, to black-white things.
Mm-hmm.
It's either this or that.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to kind of piggyback on Mary's comments, and when she said, take what's good and leave the rest, I've heard her say this for many years and find it to be wise, that to trust, this is I guess what I want to say, to trust that there's a higher reality that is, the church is changing also.
Mm-hmm.
However fast or slow, and this is the way, this is the form, for whatever reason. Thank you, can't hear it, huh? I'm sorry.
I'm gonna change the battery in it.
Okay. Just to finish really quickly, I don't want to interrupt Mary's talk here, but I just wanted to make that point that to trust the chaos, to trust the change that's coming, while remembering, huh, what's good, not throwing the baby out with the bathwater. So I just want to throw in my two again.
I love it when Ron is looking and kind of calms me down. I get passionate about these things. Thank you for your question. And that's true with all the changes in our life. We have such a deep individual passion for whatever it is, and we tend to get attached to our beliefs, our views, the people in our life. And to get to the point where we can, and this talks about in the Bible, it talks about it in all the different scriptures, and by the way, in our book we talk about all the various religions and the sameness in them and how they say the same things in all the various scriptures. And to be not attached to the fruits of our actions, that's the way it says it in the Bhagavad Gita, the scriptures of the yoga tradition. In our Bible, it says something similar. And it's coming back and loving so intensely and being willing to be present with that love. And then in the next moment, let go into the next moment. And as I said, it's very difficult to do that when our attachments. Now, my son died in 1985. He was 18 years old. He was riding he was a passenger on a motorcycle.
Mm-hmm.
And he was thrown off and killed. And it was an incredible, the most difficult thing in my life to get through. I was also at the time a substance abuse counselor, and I made a decision in that moment, and my spiritual focus has been my entire life. I have parents and grandparents that were very focused on spirituality. So I made a decision the moment I heard that he died, that I was going to use his death to spiritually transform me. And I'd like to read to you a little bit about what came from that. I'm kind of focusing also on the book around remembrance too, because there it's important to have that memory of our loved ones. Our loved ones changed our lives. We can't help but remember them with great love. But also we're attached to our loved ones, and there's that incredible pain that comes with that. And when he died, I started writing a journal, and that journal was very important to me. It was like my best friend, because I was able to say anything in that journal. I was able to express my anger in that journal. I was able to take from my emotions the wisdom that came out of it by writing. I was able to find 3 or 4 months down the line when I felt like all the raw pains came through, before I was in shock and denial. And the raw pains was trying to come through the raw emotions. I could see, looking back on my journal, that I had progressed. That it wasn't just feeling like it just happened. So I'd like to just read this here a little bit about what I went through on page 42. It says, when my son died, I experienced all of these effects. I guess I was talking about something else before this. Oh, I see. The physical manifestations of a shock include feelings of numbness, heaviness, and exhaustion. Sighing and shortness of breath may occur, and often one gains or loses weight and has difficulty sleeping. And again, you have on your list the various experiences you may go through, both physically, mentally, cognitively, emotionally, and spiritually. So when my son died, I experienced all of these effects. Yet on another level, I could feel that I was moving towards a deeper understanding of love and life itself. When I first heard of Ken's death, I remember making a decision that if I had to go through the pain of this loss, I would use this time as a spiritual journey. I wrote and talked about my experience, investigating my dreams, did collage work, and meditated and prayed, continually examining the pain as it presented itself. There were days that I would sob, and then would be a clearing when the grass was intensely beautiful and the sky was incredibly blue. In moments of feeling so much love and so much pain at the same time, I felt very alive and surrendering to the magnitude of the mystery of life and death. I was aware of and felt an unseen presence guiding me through the process. It felt as though I was being held. And I go on to talk about synchronicity. How many of you know the word synchronicity? It's great, great. Mm-hmm. Carl Jung coined it, meaning coincidences that go beyond coincidences. It's like a guidance from God. Okay, and we see it sometimes, and we can see it more intensely when we're in intense grief, I have found, in my experience of working with people as well as myself. And so I could see the many synchronicities that were now taking place in my life, and could feel the guidance and the flow of life in these various experiences. For instance, on the day of the funeral, it was late in the afternoon, and friends and relatives had gathered at our house. After talking with a friend who had come to the funeral, I thought to myself, I haven't eaten all day, and I probably should eat something. And just then, someone handed me a plate of food. And I then talked for another 10 minutes, and I thought, I don't have a fork. And someone handed me a fork. And these kinds of events happened over and over again, and my heart was broken open, and I was being shown a whole new dimension of being. Throughout the first few years after Ken's death, life was extremely difficult. Within the first months, I felt open and vulnerable. It seemed so intense that all I could do was surrender to the process. I felt humble as the waves of pain washed over me. The less I resisted my painful experiences, the more life flowed. I was a substance abuse counselor at the time, and part of my job was working with individuals in crisis. I found myself being with these clients in a transformative way. that were surprising to both my employer and to myself. I found that by letting go of what I had no power to change, I became more open to the sacredness of life. My mere presence affected others in a powerful way. Many clients felt healed just by talking with me. And for that period of time, I was so open to the pain and so surrendered to the process that life just flowed through me. And I really encourage you, in life itself, every moment worth having changes. It's just that when we have a profound experience of pain, that's when we really feel the transformative power of it more fully if we are willing to open to it. So.